Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, some books coming out in 2025 to get excited about, and what makes Sedona such a good backdrop for crime stories. But first, it's time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I want to review a comprehensive review of the election system so that I am comfortable with the election processes, including security protocols, chain of custody, you know, everything.
It is time to invest in renewable energy, create good-paying green jobs, and protect our water for generations to come. We simply cannot allow corporate greed and political corruption to stand in our way.
It provides a statistical advantage to the group of candidates listed first. The legislature saw fit to fairly, in my view, provide that advantage to the party that had won the governor's office, and the Dems were butthurt about it, and they were being sore losers.
The ESA program has proven itself to be a big fat target for fraud, and it is keeping my office busy in prosecuting fraud cases, and I think the two fraud investigations and prosecutions that we have underway are likely only the tip of the iceberg.
I think of Wayne Gretzky's quote, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take." So I'm forming an advisory committee of visionary leaders dedicated to bringing NHL hockey back to the Valley.
And with me to talk about some new priorities for the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, preview the legislative session, which starts on Monday, and more, are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Reginald Boulding. Reginald,
good morning
to you. So let's start with new U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego. He and Senator Mark Kelly have both come out in favor of what is called the Laken-Riley Act, sort of the first big immigration-related bill that the U.S. Senate has come up with. So I'm specifically curious for Senator Gallego, how are Democrats responding to his not only supporting it, but co-sponsoring it in the Senate?
Well, you know, I don't think it was a secret that, you know, immigration was going to be topic of discussion, you know, during, you know, this session in Congress. You know, Donald Trump ran on it. You know, you started to see many Democrats move, you know, to be more border hawks during the election. I think right now what you're seeing in Democratic parties, people are saying that it's okay to have a conversation around, you know, deportation and what that looks like. But it's not okay to eliminate due process rights. And that's what this actually act does. And so when Senator Gallego came out and, you know, not only showing his support for it, but co-sponsoring it, I think a lot of people, especially those in the, you know, Latino community, they're taking a step back to say, hey, you know, Senator, we fought for you. We believe in you. We know that there's going to be a conversation regarding deportations, but we can't erode our due process rights and, you know, allow Homeland Security to, you know, hold people indefinitely if they're accused of crimes.
Within Democratic circles, Reginald, is there a sense of like that this might be a sign of things to come? Or is there a sense of maybe, OK, you know, obviously immigration is a big deal. The Senate is controlled by Republicans. You know, people are starting to maybe move to the right just a little bit. This is maybe just a one off.
Well, I don't think Ruben has completely lost his base yet, right? I think people understood.
Yeah, he's been in office for like 10
right,
minutes.
Right. I don't think he's lost the base yet. But I do think that people are expecting him to really stand up and be on the front lines when it comes to some of the more aggressive, you know, border policies, right? You know, if you're talking about, you know, deporting individuals who've been convicted of crimes, you know, I think the generality of the public, they understand that. But once you start talking about, you know, splitting, you know, apart families, you know, eliminating due process rights, going into communities, they are expecting Ruben Gallego as a border state senator to kind of, you know, fight against some of these things.
Well, so, Lorna, this seems like kind of a fine line that Senator Gallego has to walk. I mean, he said earlier that he's going to take a wait and see approach mm-hmm. with some of President-elect Trump's immigration priorities. How difficult a balancing act might this be for Senator Gallego?
Well, it's definitely a difficult balancing act. And, you know, obviously you said he's only been in office for 10 days. I mean, that was the shortest lived honeymoon period amongst, you know, fellow Democrats I've ever witnessed. But, I mean, it makes sense. He was elected to represent the state of Arizona. This was not a landslide victory for Democrats by any means. It was a small margin against not the best Republican candidate, let's be honest. So this wasn't some kind of, you know, vote of the public saying we want a progressive Democrat person representing Arizona. So I think he's taking that to heart. When it comes to immigration policy, he is taking a smart approach, right? There's all of this, you know, hyperbole out there and angst about what Trump is going to do when it comes to immigration. We don't know, right? There hasn't been any specific policy proposals. So he's taking it step by step about what's being placed in front of him. And this is right now, this current bill is what's been placed in front of him. And I think for people to make these broad statements about just immigration in general versus what this act specifically does, which pertains to people committing crimes, theft and burglary and whatnot, I think there is a lot of even Democrat, you know, voters that support, you know, deporting or detaining individuals who have broken the law. And this is part of that conversation that needs to be had. And I think Rubin is kind of taking Democrats back to a time closer to 20 years ago where you could have these conversations and not be attacked for it, right? Here in Arizona, it was a Democrat governor, you know, Napolitano, who signed the employer sanctions law, mandatory e-verify in the state. And other Democrats at the legislature used to co-sponsor immigration-related bills. And then since then, it's been this shift where it's either you're either with us or entirely against us. And I think Rubin is being very smart about this because, again, he represents the state of Arizona. And voters made it very clear how they feel about immigration here. And, you know, he's taking a wise approach by not going to the far left and just voting for and supporting policies that he thinks are right for the state.
Would you extrapolate that out with his whole like wait and see approach? Does that politically, it seems like based on what you just said, that would also sort of be the smart approach, not to come out and say everything Trump is going to do, I'm going to vote against, or everything he's going to do is going to be terrible. But to, as you say, wait and see what the legislation is in front of him and make a decision based on that.
No, definitely. I mean, there could be some really extreme policies that come out of this administration. There could be some, you know, reasonable things that Democrats can get behind. So it doesn't make any sense for him to come out in opposition to what we don't know is coming before us, right? And I know there's people that are trying to pressure him and take that stance. But one, it's irresponsible. And two, it's not actually representing the people of Arizona that he was elected to represent.
Reginald, I mentioned Senator Mark Kelly is also says he's supportive of the Laken Riley Act. When it passed the House, every Democratic member of Arizona's delegation, except for Raul Grijalva, who wasn't there, and new Representative Yasemin Ansari also voted for it. Is this telling in some way of how Democrats in Arizona are thinking about immigration issues?
You know, I really think right now, you know, we know that there's going to be a number of different policies. And you know, again, with this policy being the one that's in front of lawmakers, I do think the devil is in the details, right? So as a policymaker, you have to make sure that you're looking at the line by line, what makes sense. And, you know, for, you know, us to, you know, this bill is being painted as, you know, deporting individuals who've committed crimes. That's one aspect. But it's also there's also components of here that would eliminate due process, allowing for, you know, the detaining of individuals who are just accused of committing acts. So that's when it starts to get a little bit too far. But I do think, you know, Senator Gallego and the other, you know, delegation here, they're going to have to operate really under what Trump campaigned on. And, you know, a lot of that is, you know, a more extremist policy, separating families, raiding workplaces, and, you know, That's the environment that we're in, and we're going to see what kind of, you know, lawmakers, you know, how they shift and position and support or advocate against some of these policies.
Lorna, let's make a turn with, I guess, a sort of an awkward transition to the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, not talking about immigration, talking about another big issue, though, elections. Mm-hmm. And the new supervisors were sworn in this week, and one of their first things that they said they want to do is to, not an audit, but a review. Look.
Yes.
Examination, whatever other word you want to use, of the county's election system. And it seems as though the new chair, Thomas Galvin, kind of went out of his way to say, no, this isn't like a cyber ninjas kind of thing, mm-hmm. not an audit per se, just kind of reviewing everything. again, talking about delicate balances that Senator Gallego has to walk, this seems kind of like a delicate balance, too.
Well, it was more of a clarification by Chairman Galvin, which was an important clarification because the word audit in the state of Arizona and even nationally is politically loaded, right? Everyone has a certain connotation of what that means, and they think of cyber ninjas and everything that happened with the 2020 election. And this is the complete opposite of that. And as Chairman Galvin mentioned, there is no question, there was no fraud, there is no question of how elections have been handled in Maricopa County. This is now a question of what are the best practices? Are there areas in which we can improve? Are there other policy recommendations that we need to make to the legislature to make sure that our systems are operating at the best capacity? And, you know, as government at any level on any topic, there should always be a review of your systems and processes to make sure that you're working as efficiently as possible. And so that's what they're doing. And so it was very important for Chairman Galvin to make sure and clarify to the general public, we're not pulling ballots, we're not hand counting ballots, we're not questioning the validity of the elections. It's just a question of, do we have enough staffing? Do we have enough machines? What do we need to do to make this better? Because all eyes continue to be on Arizona, and we're going to see that happen with a very contested, 2026 gubernatorial election, future U.S. Senate races. So what can we do to make sure that we're doing everything as Maricopa County to make sure that, there can be no question moving forward of how we operate?
Do you think the general public will see and understand that distinction?
I think it's important for, as Chairman Galvin did, for the Board of Supervisors to communicate what that is. And as he mentioned, obviously they have to determine what the scope of work would be for this review, which is going to be, in future, county supervisor board meetings that are going to be public. So, it's going to be incumbent on them for them to continue to communicate to the media and the public what this is and what it's not, because people can easily turn it into a different circus of what it actually isn't. So I think you're going to continue to see the board talk about this more. But yeah, it's an important distinction for them to make.
Let me ask you the same question, Reginald, because I would imagine that it would be fairly easy for somebody to look at, sort of a headline or something. Maricopa County says it's going to review election procedures and think, oh, wait, didn't they do this? Like, didn't we go through this already?
This is, I would say a softball to the base, right? You want to make sure your base knows that, you're there. And I think that there's a base in the Republican Party that want to make sure that, elections are still a conversation. When you see, a Supervisor Lesko, a big chunk of her constituents, they're supporting something like this, right? And I think, initially in the primaries, Chairman Galvin and then also Supervisor Brophy McGee, there is conversation with regards to how will you step up and how will you make sure that, election fraud's not happening at the county. So I think this is kind of, giving one to the base. I think ultimately, that headline is probably what the supervisors needed to, say, to folks that, we're looking into it. Will anything come out of it? I don't think so. If there's going to be any election changes, it's going to be at the legislature.
So, guys, on Monday, Governor Katie Hobbs will deliver her State of the State address to officially kick off the legislative session. So, Reginald, I want to start with you because that was something you used to go to as an elected official, as a minority leader in the legislature. There's been so much talk about things like water and housing and the budget, of course. Like, is that kind of what you're expecting to be the biggies coming up?
I think so. I think Governor Hobbs, she's going to talk about, big issues that particularly that can get, buy-in from Republicans and also some Democrats in the legislature. So I don't think you're going to see too many or hear too many policies, in the state of the state that Republicans are going to come out and say, DOA on, right? As opposed to, when she first started, they're tearing up the state of the states. And that's dead on arrival. That's dead on arrival. So I think she'll try to move more to the center. I think you'll hear more on border. We know, Prop 123 is the education component is going to be extremely important. So you'll hear some of that. But it's going to be folks are going to be looking specifically to see how she talks about how she wants to work together with this legislature, which is probably one of the most conservative than we've seen in decades.
Yeah. How do you think Governor Hobbs should try to do that with a legislature that is perhaps more conservative, but certainly more Republican?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, how she sets the tone and the approach of her speech on Monday is really going to determine how easily or not easily she's going to be able to work with the leaders down there. I mean, you're coming off an election cycle that was very intense, where Democrats thought they were going to pick up more seats or even take over one chamber, right? That she was intimately involved in that effort. They were not successful. And there's some, and Republicans are not going to forget that, right? And so they're going into this session with a lot of the momentum in their caucus, and they have bold policies that are very in the similar topics that, you know, Reginald just mentioned that the governor is going to hit on when it comes to water, education, funding, housing, whatnot. It's the difference in approach, right? And it's going to be incumbent on the governor when she speaks to the legislature on Monday about working with both parties, right? And it's that's going to be difficult for her because, as we've seen with the dynamics with Ruben Gallego right now, she has members of her caucus down there that want her to kind of be that firebrand, right, mm-hmm. and fight against Republicans and fight against Trump and this, that, and the other. But as the governor, she needs to lead and govern, right, and take a much more measured approach. And so when it comes to border security, immigration, Prop 123, you know, education funding, you got to work with the Republicans down there if you want to get anything done.
Well, so what lessons do you take from maybe last year when there were efforts to get a Prop 123 initiative to voters? And they did do some housing things, but presumably there will be more. And there was some bipartisan discord on water, things like that, issues that are still most likely going to come up this year, but have not necessarily led to compromise in the past. What does that tell you about maybe different approaches for this year?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's still the same topics as last session, and a number of bills were vetoed or things got sidelined and whatnot. And it's going to be a question of, has she shifted her approach at all, right? Because I think a lot of the Republican leaders down there, and we've seen in the previous days of this week with them talking about their agenda, I don't think they've shifted much when it comes to their approach on water and housing, right? And so it's going to be a question of, how does Hobbs handle those conversations with the leaders down there? And there might be a situation where nothing gets done, right, on those topics, right, unfortunately, because there's not going to be the give and take. But again, Republicans built up their majority, right? They have the momentum behind them. And so it's just really going to be, what does Hobbs determine this session is the line in the sand for her when it comes to governing as a Democrat? But there's a big giant question mark when it comes to these big policy issues. And as you mentioned with Prop 123, they kicked the can down the road last session. They have a time. There has to be a special election
soon.
This year,
yeah.
very
yeah.
soon. I know there's questions about the deadline, whether it's this month or next month, but they got to take action on it. And so I would imagine that that's going to be the main focus of her speech on Monday, and how she if she can negotiate successfully with Republicans on getting Prop 123 on the ballot, I think that's good momentum for her going into the session.
Yeah, I'm curious about what you think, Reginald, about the prospects for compromise, because we did see some last year, especially on housing bills, but we also saw a lot of acrimony between the legislative Republicans and the governor's office. Do you have optimism that there can be common ground this year?
Well, we know, like, not only will the state of the state be, you know, sort of the opening for the session, it will also be the first speech, the 2026 reelection campaign for Governor Hobbs,
yeah.
right? So with that being said, Republicans in the chamber, they understand that as well, right? And for them, you know, having to compromise on policies and vetoes and budgets, they don't like that. So, you know, I do think that, you know, even in areas where there are going to be common ground, there's going to be a political force at play that's saying, you know, do we want this to be seen as a political win for the governor? You know, the governor has to run the entire government in the state. And lawmakers, they don't have that same responsibility. So that provides them some more flexibility to say no. But I would say, you know, House and Senate Democrats, they're going to have a lot more. I think they're going to have power. Folks may see them as marginalized. But when you look at, you know, last session, you know, the ACA or, you know, Prop 400, those things, you know, even Prop 123, you know, once you leave, those things don't get passed without some Democrats. And there's going to be some Republicans in both caucuses that aren't going to vote for whatever, you know, coming from Katie Hobbs. And while there was an increase in the number of Republicans in these chambers, it's not so significant that, you know, Democrats in the legislature won't be needed. There are definitely going to be a need to bring some Democrats to the table.
Lorna, do you think that Governor Hobbs breaks her veto record from a couple years ago this year?
I don't think. Well, interesting, because as Reginald just mentioned, there is a huge political dynamic going
yeah.
into this session. Normally in an off year, you know, you don't really think about the upcoming election. But this is kicking off the 2026 gubernatorial campaign. And so, you know, there might be attempts from Republicans to just throw things up there, you know, that they know she's going to veto. That might be an approach from them. I do think that she might be much more measured when it comes to the bills that come to her desk and signing that. I don't think she will – there will be as much pomp and circumstance around her vetoes. I don't think she's going to promote as much as she did in previous years.
Posting images on social media.
I don't think that'll necessarily be her approach. I think she's really going to try to focus much more on compromise because she needs people to get some of her agenda accomplished. She needs to get her nominees through. She needs to be able to figure out a way to work with these leaders.
Well, so that raises an interesting question, Reginald, about kicking off the 2026 gubernatorial campaign. And I'm curious, like, in your mind, what is maybe more important for the governor? We talked about Lorna mentioned, you know, the image of her fighting and, you know, standing up to Republicans. Is that more important, in which case vetoes might be beneficial, or is like the ability to compromise and govern and get stuff done? Does that become more important?
Yeah, I think the governor has to, you know, walk into this approach that I am the adult in the room. I'm going to, you know, look at common sense approaches to solutions. And, you know, I do think a overcalculation by Republicans is if they put very extreme policies and they send them to her desk, if the governor can re-message those as, hey, look, if, you know, whoever the nominee for Republican governor, they're going to just do whatever this legislature says. If she can make that direct connection that, hey, you want to keep me here. I'm the common sense person here. I'm not too far right, not too far left. You know, you want someone like me that can stay governing. I think she could be successful. I do think, though, right now, you know, the governor is has to, you know, show what her vision is for the state. And if the legislature chooses, you know, to completely, you know, balk at that, and I think that that's something that she has to, you know, message out to the public.
Lorna, lastly, briefly before we leave, you mentioned this is the kickoff to the 2026 campaign for governor. There are other people in that chamber who might be thinking about running for governor or other statewide offices as well. Safe to say that, like, potentially kicking off their campaigns sounds like a custom-made collision course.
Oh, of course. I mean, that was just one layer of the political dynamics. But yeah, there are people in that chamber or people who will be watching that chamber closely that are looking to, you know, throw their name in the hat for various offices for 2026, right? And so, yeah, anytime that you can, you know, either stand up against, you know, the governor of the state of Arizona or this, that, and the other, and that's an opportunity to fundraise, right? And so, yeah, there's going to be, whether it comes to education funding, water, border security, immigration, I think that's going to be the big one. You're going to see a number of Republicans take a public stance if the governor comes out with something that they're opposed to.
All right, I'll have to leave it there. Lorna Romero-Ferguson, Reginald Boulding, thanks you guys both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why one author says the beautiful red rocks of Sedona are the perfect setting for true crime. But first, with the calendar flipped to 2025, we wanted to take a look at some of the books that are coming out in the weeks and months to come. And to do that, I'm joined by Valley-based book critic Mark Athatakis. And Mark, let's start with the big picture. What trends are you expecting in the new year?
Well, we have a second Trump administration coming in, so it's deja vu all over again. One thing that we learned the first time around with Trump is that he is very happy to be vindictive toward anybody who is demonstrating what he perceives as criticism of what he's doing. We saw this in the case where he and ABC News reached a $15 million settlement. And, you know, he has had ongoing litigation against Bob Woodward and Simon & Schuster for a book that Woodward published. And I think the issue is specifically in the legal terms about his use of actual recordings of Donald Trump's voice. But, I mean, in a broader sense, this is part of a pattern of trying to chill journalists and journalism. So it will be interesting slash frustrating to see how the publishing community responds to this.
So in the non-politics realm, mm-hmm. what are you looking forward to in nonfiction?
Oh, there's it looks to be a promising year so far. And so there are a few books that I wanted to highlight. One comes out in January by Kyle Paoletta called American Oasis. And what it is, it's a journalistic study of the current American Southwest. And I think living here in Phoenix, we are very used to people who are not in the Southwest, telling us who we are and scolding
us. They kind of parachute in and tell everybody else how bad it is, right?
Right, and that Phoenix should not exist and that this is an unsustainable part of the country, et cetera, et cetera. And Paoletta is critical of the history of the Southwest and how it has overexploited its resources. But he's also mindful of the fact that most of the United States is facing a drought, that issues of sustainability and how we work with native land and how we build relationships and manage that relationship and how we talk about the history of the land here, because he goes back to – he's an Albuquerque native and he talks about, you know, the eras of the conquistadors and how native history has been erased in some ways to kind of make the Southwest more appealing. So, you know, he's suggesting that the Southwest is an interesting mirror for the whole of America and the whole of contemporary American life. So another interesting novel that is coming out in early January is – The Life of Herod the Great by Zora Neale Hurston. Now, Zora Neale Hurston is most famous for her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. And this is an unfinished novel that almost didn't see the light of day. When she died in 1960, the people who were cleaning out her house were setting various things on fire to dispense them, including a chest that contained some unpublished manuscripts. Now, a friend of hers who was driving by saw this and recognized that a chest owned by a famous author was something that may contain something important. So he stopped, got a garden hose, put out the fire, and recovered the novel. And this has been – it is unfinished. It is a story about King Herod, and Hurston's take is that not that Herod was an evil New Testament villain, but was in many ways sort of a precursor to the Jesus Christ story.
We often hear in times of divisiveness or difficult times, I mean, obviously, you know, the economy for a lot of people is not great right now, that it can be difficult for day-to-day life, but can lead to some unbelievable art and, you know, writing and things like that. Is there a sense that there that, you know, people writing about sort of what's going on now could lead to really interesting either fiction or nonfiction in 2025?
I think so. And I think one other novel that I believe exemplifies this coming out in March is Leila Lalami's The Dream Hotel. We all recognize that we are being surveilled in various ways by our apps, by our TV viewing habits. Mm-hmm. Everything seems to be fed into an algorithm, and we've almost just made peace with the fact that that is, you know, just part of what it means to be a living, connected human being these days. And I think this is a very dark dystopian novel that talks about the end consequences of that. And so I think there is maybe a feeling more of an obligation amongst many writers these days to be on the news and be aware of, you know, there's a cliche in the world say like, you know, fiction reveals what it means to be human. And that's true. But I think the questions of like, what sort of things do people have agency to do? What can we do? What can we not do? What sort of things are going to be policed? I think those things are thrown in the sharper relief. So I think maybe what we'll be seeing out of writers is more close attention to that.
Interesting. You and I talked not that long ago about sort of the prominence and prevalence of political books, especially 2024 being an election year. Is 2025 going to be a break from that? We talked about some of the concerns publishers might have about being sued, for example, by the Trump administration or the Trump team. But in general, are we getting a break from political books this year?
I don't think we're getting a break from political books this year because we never do. But you know, the publishing industry moves on apace and we are still going to see celebrity biographies. The second volume of Cher's memoir is going to come out. Beyonce's mother has a memoir that is coming out. There's a Brooke Shields memoir. So there'll be a lot of that. I'm also – one thing maybe that sort of kind of splits that divide between how do we talk about politics and how do we talk about celebrity. There's a couple of books that may be of interest related to that. There's a biography of Lorne Michaels, who is the founder and creator of
SNL,
of Saturday Night Live, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And the book does an interesting job of getting into not just Lorne Michaels' sort of rise to the position of comedy royalty, but also about, you know, what does political satire look like now? Lorne Michaels has obviously infuriated various viewers and some of his cast members by inviting, say, Donald Trump or Elon Musk to host the show. His attitude is that, you know, comedy and satire should have no friends, really. It should be willing to attack anybody and everything. So it's interesting to read a book like that in the context of the current moment. There's also a book that I found very entertaining called Funny Because It's True, which is a history of The Onion, which is the satirical newspaper, which started out simply as just a cheap sort of almost like kind of a coupon clipper newspaper at the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus that grew. But the interesting thing about the book, which is written by Catherine Wentz, who was an editor very early on, is that The Onion started as a very Gen X way of sort of sticking it to the man, that it was satirizing the corporatized system. Now, of course, what happened with The Onion is that it became a very popular, successful, corporatized kind of publication. And it gets into some of the issues and kind of the hypocrisies of, you know, having to deal with the ownership and dealing with, you know, what is it like to satirize the state of corporate America while you're actually exemplifying some of its worst characteristics. Yeah.
All right. That is Mark Athatakis, a freelance book critic based here in the Valley. Mark, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. When many people picture Sedona, they picture paradise. But one Arizona writer says the picture is a bit more complicated. The show's Sam Dingman has the story.
Kathleen Bryant is a writer who spent many years living in Sedona. And she says there's this feeling people sometimes get the first time they visit Sedona.
Ah, Red Rock fever. You fall in love with the landscape, and it's like being enchanted. The red rocks can be really seductive and magnetic. They'll pull you out of your vehicle before you even think about water or the right shoes or a map.
Red rock fever can be a serious condition. Bryant wrote a piece for Crime Reads recently about Sedona's long history of unexplained disappearances. For decades now, people have been seduced by the red rocks, not to mention the town's reputation as a hub of mystical energies. And sometimes they wander into the wilderness and they don't come back. Bryant tells a fictionalized version of one such story in her latest novel, Over the Edge, where a writer named Delilah Cooper confronts the darker side of Sedona. It's based partly on Bryant's real life. As she told me recently, the day she moved to Sedona, she turned on her car radio and heard a report that there was a murderer on the loose.
When I drove up to my apartment and started unpacking, the landlord came out and warned me. He said, you know, be sure you lock your doors because there's this escapee on the loose and you need to be careful. God.
That's your first few minutes in town, right?
Yeah. I hadn't even gotten into the apartment yet or into my space. And already I was learning that it wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. It's such a great illustration of the tension that seems to float in the air in Sedona in your formulation. And that's a big part of the story that you're telling in Over the Edge. What's interesting to you about that tension?
Sedona is, it can just be so charming. You know, it's got the small town charm. It's a community that's known for its spiritual side, for its artistic residents. So you can kind of lose sight or get a false sense of security about what dangers there might be out there in the wilderness. Wilson Mountain is named after a man who was killed by a grizzly bear. And then years later, someone claimed to have seen his ghost. So there's always been these stories about hauntings or criminals out on the forest. It was a hideout for bootleggers. Now and then when I was out hiking on a trail, I'd come across parts of a still, that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
Sterling Pass is named after a counterfeiter who hid out in the wilderness.
Wow.
But yeah, there's a lot of these stories.
Counterfeiter is particularly interesting in the context of what we're talking about and of your book, because in the book, Del Cooper, again, your heroine, has, to my mind at least, a pretty healthy skepticism about the faux spiritual element of Sedona, the people who are there to try to sell you, you know, fake crystals and that sort of thing. But in a way, Del is also there for similar reasons to the seekers, whose reasons she might see as somewhat shallow. She's there to run away from this terrible thing that happened to her in her life back east, and she's sort of trying to reinvent herself. So, you know, reasons or methodology for self-discovery aside, do you think Sedona is a uniquely opportune place to reinvent yourself?
I do, although I think that it depends on the person. I'm really nature-oriented, so I find my sense of balance and healing when I'm outdoors walking in nature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, other people might be drawn to a past life regression or
right.
Some kind of healing ceremony. Mm-hmm. And in Sedona, you can have both.
That's true. When you got there, and you had this first interaction with your landlord who was like, lock your doors, there's a murderer on the loose. What did you think in that moment?
I think I took it with a grain of salt. I thought it was a situation that would pass. And mostly I was just excited to be there. I couldn't wait to get out on the trails. And I don't remember being afraid to go out hiking by myself, even during that time period.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about how being out in nature is restorative for you.
Absolutely.
Because there's a really haunting part of the book for me. It's one of my favorite sequences where Del goes out into the wilderness to look for one of the other characters in the book, Jane. And she gets just like totally overwhelmed. And she's out there and she has all these questions about this murder that has happened and who in her circle might be connected to it, and that she's surrounded by all the rocks and all the winding trails, and she just kind of folds in on herself a little bit. And I'm just curious to know where did that sequence come from for you? It was so vivid.
I have to say that a lot of things that happened to Del in the book, I experienced at some point while I lived in Sedona. And there was one hike that I went on. It was late in the day, like not long before sunset, way out, you know, like quite a few miles off the beaten track, just driving to get to the trailhead. And then I went on a side trail that also was very remote. And while I was there, I heard footsteps. So I did start running back to the car, mm-hmm. you know, hoping not to hear those footsteps. And I just didn't know what was following me or who.
Yeah, boy, that's a very chilling scene that you've just described. And it makes me think about in your piece for Crime Reads, you conclude it by saying that you wrote the book Over the Edge for all the people who have gone missing in Sedona over the decades. And hearing you tell that story, I almost get the sense that in a moment like that, you're confronted with the fact that it could be easy for one of those people to be you.
Absolutely. Things can change so quickly when you're out there, especially if you're out there alone. And that's why, you know, you shouldn't hike alone. And I know that. And yet I love that quiet and solitude of hiking by myself. So I would violate my own number one rule and go out on my own, even knowing that something could happen. And yeah, I had some close calls.
Yeah. But you kept going on the hikes, right?
Yeah, I did. Like I said, it's absolutely seductive. It is such an enchanting landscape. I think Dell is intuitive, and she just doesn't realize it yet that she has more in common with some of the psychics and spiritual people than she realizes. And you can't always separate creativity and spirituality. For a lot of people, those are the same things. And risk can be part of beauty. Just the fact that you're opening yourself up, whether it's to your muse or to experiences, there's a certain element of risk in being that vulnerable.
Well, Kathleen Bryant is the author of the book Over the Edge. Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate it.
Phoenix lost a punk rock legend this week, and Robert Palo lost a dear friend. Here's Palo with a portrait of the unforgettable Robert X. Plant.
Anyone who's known me for any amount of time has heard me use the phrase shrieking nightmare from hell to describe things I find unpleasant. They've heard me threaten to kill myself with an axe when things don't go my way. But that's not me. What they're really hearing is me quoting the absurdist comedy and over-the-top expression of the artist Robert X. Plant, who died earlier this week. He was 74. These were expressions I lifted from Robert X., whose conversations and celebrated writings and punk rock songs were littered with delightful, descriptive phrases like that. Robert X., a proud Phoenix native, had that effect on everyone in his orbit. He left an impression. He changed the way we thought, the way we saw things, the way we talked. His own voice was, like the man himself, distinct and preposterous. A slow, comforting honk, like gravel frying in brown butter. When I heard that my longtime friend had died unexpectedly in his sleep, my first thought was, when did Planet have time to sleep? He was, even well into his dotage, always working on something. Most recently, I'm told, his memoirs. Oh, the stories he could have told in those pages. Robert X. Plant, whose real name was Robert Severance, is best known locally as a journalist at Phoenix New Times, the City Weekly. There, in the 1980s and 1990s, he wrote about art and culture, but as an insider, someone who had himself designed costumes and sets and made paintings and written music and appeared on the stage. But Plant was known globally as a frontman of Killer Pussy, the satirical punk rock outfit founded in 1982 by his muse and best friend, the actress and singer Lucy LaMode. Plant joined the band, which was named after punk diva Les Agogo's pet cat, and they scored regional hits with songs Robert and Lucy wrote for their debut EP. The band followed up with an album full of songs with titles like Pepperoni Ice Cream and Moist Towelette. Among their biggest fans were the actor Dennis Hopper and a young Sarah Jessica Parker, who displayed a poster of the band in her 1980s sitcom, Square Pegs.
It's not a very pretty job, but someone's got to do it. Teenage and I'm a nurse. Teenage and I'm a nurse.
I used to sometimes quote to Robert X lyrics from his songs, most of them much too vulgar for me to repeat here on the radio. He would close his eyes and smile and nod his head. I always had the impression that he liked that his friends and fans stole phrases and ideas from him, that he thought inspiring us and others was his duty. Though I remember he was less than happy when a musical he wrote about Arizona Governor Evan Meekum was lifted by a local troupe who ran with it and created their own similar project. Robert and I were both amused that a handful of people thought we were the same person. I guess because we worked at the same newspaper and our names were similar, or maybe because we lived on the same street for a number of years. But there was only one Robert X. Plant. The day after Robert X died, Lucy Lamode sent me a video of him playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow on his accordion. In the video, he's walking through a crowd of revelers at the Burning Man celebration, an event that meant a great deal to Robert. Suddenly, the sun breaks through the clouds, a rainbow appears, and without breaking his stride, Robert X begins playing that famous Harold Arlen tune. Robert X Planet was our very own strolling minstrel, weaving in and out of a crowd of admirers who were thrilled to be his friend. For my part, I'll think of Robert X Planet every time I see a moist towelette.
That was KJZZ contributor Robert Palo remembering his friend Robert X Planet.
On my party dress, but it'll cost me no distress. No, I've got such a voice.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. Remember, you can always follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.
Your shirt is streaked with spots and drips and void. Do you have any?